Today, we will be talking about privacy and starting with this old but good picture of Elvis Presley at the moment he impulsively married his wife, Priscilla. They were in Las Vegas, and on the spur of the moment, they decided to run to the chapel and get married. And you can see that, obviously, if something like that happens, there's the excitement that you do it on the spur of the moment and everything. But you don't have time to make any arrangements. So you need all of the surrounding and kinds of factors and supporting staff and everything to be assembled very quickly, which is done very easily in Las Vegas. They have people ready to go all the time to marry you if you want to get married. And so they went in, got married, had the cake quickly made with the names decorated onto the side. And then they had musicians and such at the ceremony. Now, and of course, it's Elvis Presley, so he knows all kinds of musicians that could have been at his wedding. He could have had musicians that were his best friends or people he'd known all his life and so on. But instead, because it happened so quickly, he ended up just getting the house musicians, the people that they just happened to have at the chapel. And so you have this guy here with the yellow circle around his face. And the question that's being asked here is, well, in some sense, is this an intrusion upon the privacy of Elvis and his wife? I mean, this is, for anyone, this is one of the most important and, in some sense, private moments of their existence, the moment that they get married. They share their first kiss, they cut the cake, and so on. I mean, this is a moment for people with whom you feel very comfortable, people with whom are that you consider to be sort of part of your internal life. And it just is kind of strange to have this musician here right next to the cake, the person who has the best view of the exactly what's happening, maybe besides the photographer, is someone playing accordion who Elvis Presley probably does not even know, had never met before that day, and Priscilla also. So the question I'm asking here is this an invasion of privacy? I mean, it's very hard to tell. I mean, it seems like no one is particularly objecting, so it can't be an extreme or terrible invasion of privacy. But nevertheless, it does seem strange to have, again, the person who has the best seat at the highly personal moment of the wedding, the person who has the best seat is some accordion player that no one knows. So something like that is what we are going to be exploring in this session. What counts as privacy? How do we know if something is an invasion of privacy or not? And so, as we've been saying, in general, the way this these sessions work is, first we start out by creating the human experience of autonomy or dignity and now privacy, right? This feeling you have when you're at your own wedding, let's say, and there's someone who is there who you don't know. Something like that is a moment where the notion of or the sensation or the feeling of privacy comes into clear definition in terms of your human experience, in terms of what privacy feels like. Another example of this might be if you are at a wedding on a beach. I've seen occasionally people get married I was in Puerto Rico for a while some time back, and people would occasionally come to get married on the beach. Beautiful ceremonies, of course, on the sands and the waves and the sky and the sun. But it's also true that if you're getting married on a public beach, then people are just going to kind of be wandering through, you know, in bikinis and swimsuits, kind of wandering through your wedding. And so that would be another example where you would have the human experience of privacy, sort of what counts as privacy and what doesn't count as privacy. It's not exactly a clear case, because whether it's Elvis in Las Vegas or the wedding on the beach, in both cases, the people chose to have their wedding in these places. And no one thinks that the people, for example, who are walking down the beach, it's not their fault. And the accordion player who no one knows, no one is objecting to that person's presence. But still, it does seem like there's not perfect privacy in those cases. So that's the human experience we're trying to get a hold of. What counts as privacy? When is privacy violated? When is it not violated? How do we know? How do we measure privacy? And then all of these questions, how do they exist in the world of artificial intelligence and information technology? So what I propose to do then, with having established some human sense of what privacy is, we'll look at ChatGPT's definition to get a sense. We will look at the standard definition, which is the one written by Weston in his book, Privacy and Freedom. Then we'll look at some fine-tuning points of privacy, the idea that privacy is a verb. And then we have a kind of a curious case that I always use when I talk about privacy, because I think it grips very well the technical and formal meaning of privacy. So those will be the steps to defining what privacy is. And we will start with old reliable ChatGPT, see how ChatGPT does this time. Please define privacy in 50 or fewer words. Define privacy, let's say, in AI ethics. In AI ethics, in 50 or fewer words. All right, let's see what it says. Remember it, for autonomy, the definition was solid, not perfect, but solid. The definition for dignity was not good. Let's see what happens here. Privacy in AI ethics refers to the protection and respectful use of individuals' personal data, ensuring it is not exploited or exposed without consent, and maintaining confidentiality in AI systems and applications. Okay, that's not bad. I think that we could work with that. It refers to the protection and respectful use of individuals' personal data. As always, and when ChatGPT starts, it tends to just say something that is actually nothing, but that sounds good. So privacy in AI ethics refers to the protection and respectful use of individuals' personal data. And that sounds good, but actually it means nothing, because protection and respectful use, what do those words mean? It's almost like ChatGPT is saying privacy in AI ethics refers to privacy about personal data. So I think there it's not that first clause is not good. Essentially, ChatGPT is saying privacy in AI ethics refers to privacy in individuals' personal data. That's nothing. Ensuring it is not exploited or exposed without consent. That word consent, that's the key word. So ChatGPT does pick up on the fundamental idea of the definition of privacy. Privacy has to do with whether or not you agree or do not agree to share your person, what ChatGPT calls personal data, or what I think more generally is referred to as personal information. So ChatGPT is kind of getting there. We can look at the real definition. This is the formal definition that people use in AI ethics. It comes from Alan Weston, his book, Privacy and Freedom. This is from, if I recall, sort of the late 1960s. It is not a book about artificial intelligence. Instead, it is a book about, it's kind of an anthropological book, actually, that studies the way people in different cultures, or the practices people have in different cultures of privacy. That is the way, what people in different cultures consider to be a privacy violation in terms of things like shared rooms and so on. So he does a kind of a global study and talks about privacy and freedom, a very interesting and still a very applicable book today. He starts out by saying in one of the first pages, privacy is the claim of individuals, groups, or institutions. We're mainly interested in individuals here, to determine for themselves when, how, and to what extent information about them is communicated to others. Now, of course, since he is an academic like me, he tends to take a long time to say simple things, but we can sort of boil all this down to his definition is privacy means control over access to your personal information. And when people in this field talk about privacy, they usually call this the control definition of privacy. So privacy just means you control who has access, who can see and cannot see, who can know and cannot know things that are about you. Now, that's a start, right? There's this idea that control is the key idea. Privacy has to do with the power you have over your own personal information. But there's also a second idea, and that is, well, what counts as personal information? Or sometimes people say in this field, they say personal identifying information. Because the idea that personal information could be, in some sense, personal information could be just information that I happen to have like in my pocket or something, right? My personal information in my pocket is that there are 30 million people living in New York City or something. Well, that's just information in my pocket. But personal identifying information is information that, in some sense, identifies me or connects intrinsically to who I am. So when people talk about personal information in information technology, what they actually mean is personally identifying information or personal identifying information. And sometimes you see this, the acronym is PIIL, if you see with the P, capital I, capital P, capital I, capital I, that's personal identifying information. And that's that second part of privacy. Now, as I say, it sounds easy at the start to say that the information that you have control over in privacy, the information that you want to give consent about, is personally identifying information, personal identifying information. But what exactly is that? And I have some examples here. So James Brousseau has a height. Now, I'm not sure that's personal identifying information, because all human beings have a height, right? And if you say, well, this person has a height or that person has a weight, well, that's just the same thing as saying that this is a person. So I'm not sure that that's identifying information, right? But on the other hand, I mean, it is true information, right? I mean, the fact that I have a height, and it's something that is true about me personally. So you can see that technically, you could be pushed back into a corner and have to admit, yes, I guess the fact that James Brousseau has a height is personal identifying information, because it does say something about me. But it's so broad, it says something about every person, that it seems to be, even if it's theoretically true that it identifies, practically it doesn't seem right. Whereas by contrast, if you say James Brousseau is 1 meter 95 centimeters or 6'3", yes, that is identifying information, especially in my case, for someone who is fairly tall, right? The fact that I'm 6'3" does identify me as being very different from a large part of the population. And this might be interesting for, let's say, companies like that are selling clothes. They might very well be interested in the fact that I'm 6'3", because that tells them what size clothes to send my way. And also people of different height sometimes wear different kinds of clothes work well for them. So the fact that I'm 6'3" it identifies me. It sets me apart from a lot of people in the society. And it's information that companies or someone out in the world might want about me. So there might be some conflict about consent. I mean, I might not want clothing companies to know how tall I am, because I don't want to be constantly bombarded by advertisements that say pants for, the other one is shirts for tall people, so they tuck all the way in, right? I get those ads all the time because someone somewhere has figured out that I'm very tall, and tall people have a hard time with keeping their shirts tucked in because they keep sort of pulling out. So there's this difference between James Brousseau has a height and James Brousseau is 6'3", and both of them are maybe technically personally identifying information, but I think only the second one is in a practical sense. And then another sort of example of this ambiguity is James Brousseau eats. Okay, I mean, again, that does say something about me, I guess, but that really says something about everybody. But then you can say, well, James Brousseau ate a pizza in 1994. Now, I mean, that one's not so clear. That's a long time ago, right? That's 30 years ago now. Is that personally identifying information? Maybe it shows that I'm not sure what it might show, right? I guess it might show that I wasn't living in Thailand or something in 1994. But it's hard to know because James Brousseau ate a pizza in 1994. That is fairly specific. It's kind of like my height, right? 6'3 is very specific. James Brousseau ate a pizza is very specific. But in this case, what I'm trying to show is sometimes you can get specific information about someone, but it's still not necessarily personal identifying information. It really doesn't tell us anything about that person. So here, too, there's this question about, there's this understanding that privacy means consent over who knows what about us. But the information that we have consent over or that we have power over, that continues to be a little bit of a gray area. And then the final example I have is James Brousseau loves a woman. Well, I mean, almost everyone loves their mom, right? So you could say, in some sense, James Brousseau loves a woman is not, it's like James Brousseau has a height. And this is just part of being human. But then you have this other sentence, James Brousseau loves a man. It's weird because that, even though in some technical sense, right, you love a woman, you love a man, that's 50-50 population. It doesn't seem like there's any difference between those two. I have a mom and I have a dad. But in our culture today, I think that second sentence has very different implication than the first sentence. Or it might. I suppose it depends upon who and how you see it. But that's my point, that the idea of what counts as personal identifying information is not, or the ambiguity there, is not just limited to kind of technical ambiguity, like height versus 6'3". And there's also cultural ambiguity, sort of what words mean or what is important in a society. So James Brousseau loves a woman and James Brousseau loves a man. It seems like from a technical perspective, those two sentences they're like James Brousseau has a height. I mean, everyone loves their mom and most people have their dad or someone that they feel at least strongly about, or their brothers or children or something, sons. But still, James Brousseau loves a man. Every one of you who saw that right away, they thought, right? I mean, you make a connection. So the idea is that there's these ambiguities about what counts as personal information that are both technical and social. And just the idea of figuring out what counts as identifying information about me is in of itself an entire task. And we could spend, if we had more time, we could spend a few sessions, I suppose, just talking about how what counts as personal information and how it's divided up in different societies. That's part of what happens in the Privacy and Freedom book. But we will move on. I think that we have a pretty good idea now of privacy is this idea that we control who knows what about us. So I'm a tall person. Privacy means I control whether the clothing company knows that I am tall or not. I have lost control of that. And as I said, I have lost control of that information now because I keep getting bombarded with ads for long shirts that will not come untucked. So I don't have privacy anymore about my height. I don't have privacy about the fact that I ate pizza. I don't have privacy about my height with respect to you all in this class, but I think that's a little different, right? So we can use that as an example to focus on this idea of consent. Clearly, when I told all of you in this class that I'm 6 feet, 3 inches tall, I consented to that. I mean, I decided that I would share that information with you. So that is an expression of my privacy. The fact that you know, watching this, that I am 6 feet, 3 inches tall, the fact that you know that is not a violation of my privacy, because I shared that with you voluntarily right now. I knew what I was doing. I'm an adult. I know what my height is. I decided to share that information with you. By contrast, the companies that keep sending me these ads, I don't recall ever sharing the information with them. So I did not consent for them to know that I am tall. And so the ads, that represents a privacy violation. Right? So the fact that you know how tall I am is not a privacy violation. The fact that the companies sending me these ads know how tall I am, that is a privacy violation. Of course, unless we can go back and maybe we can find that sometime when I was 18 years old, and I signed some form saying, yeah, please inform all companies that I am tall because I'm having a hard time finding clothes, which may be the case, right? And if you're tall, it sometimes can be difficult. Now with online reality, it's not. But when I was growing up, it was actually difficult to find clothes that fit me. So I may very well have signed some mailing list thing that said, look, if anyone is interested in knowing my height and sending me ads for clothes, please do that because I'm having trouble finding clothes. So maybe in that case then, going back the other way, the fact that these ads are coming at me now is not a violation of my privacy. It just reflects the fact that 30 years ago or 40 or 50 years ago, I signed some paper asking people to advertise to me if they had clothes for those who are quite tall. All right, so consent is that idea. Consent is in privacy, is the practice of me deciding who knows how tall I am, or when I ate pizza, and so on, or who I love, or when I love, and what political party I believe in, and what religion I have, and all those kinds of things, which leads to the next idea. So we have the idea of consent down to a certain extent. We have the idea of personally identifying information down to a certain extent. Then I want to fine tune that a little bit by saying that one way to understand privacy in the real world is to understand it as a verb instead of a noun. What I mean is, privacy is something you do, not something you have. And that goes back to the consent definition. If privacy means deciding, privacy is not exactly protecting your personal information. It's not hiding your personal information. This is a mistake that people frequently make when they initially begin to think about privacy. They conflate the idea of privacy with secrecy. They have the idea that, well, what is a secret, what no one else knows, that's private. No, that's not what privacy is. Privacy is not about secrets. It's not about what is known only to me. It's not the secret. And it's also not about the public. And that's why I'm showing this, have this slide from this old art exhibition. There's the idea of what is public and what everyone knows. What everyone knows about James Brousseau is that he has a height, right? That's really public information. That's not part of privacy. And I could go down the list of you all in this class, and I could just read each name, and I could say for each one of you know, Jane Jones, John Smith, etc., each of you has a height. But that's just public information, right? Then there's other information, which is secret information, right? Which is maybe for, let's just say for me, make up a secret. The secret is that I sing ABBA songs. Remember that old 70s group, ABBA, ABBA, ABBA songs in the shower. I'm just making that up. That's something I would not want anybody to know if I did that. That would be secret, right? But then there's privacy. So privacy is not about what is public knowledge. And it's not about what is secret knowledge. Instead, privacy, or the idea of consent, is the idea of deciding for yourself what is part of public knowledge. Like, my height is now more or less part of public knowledge. I'm not putting it on a video, which is can be seen by anyone on the internet at any time, anywhere in the world. There's public knowledge, and then there's the secret knowledge, like the ABBA songs. But privacy or consent is, as I put it here, it's the dial between those things, or it's the act, it's the verb of deciding what is going to be public and what will remain secret. And then secret would be things that maybe only I know, or only a very limited group of people know. And public would be things that are at least accessible to everybody. And again, privacy as a verb means that privacy is the act of moving that line between what everyone knows and what only I know, let's say. Most things are kind of in between there. Moving that line one way or the other, right? Letting some more people than eight, maybe only my, only a very few number of people who've had, right, the misfortune to live with me know, I'm just making this up, know that I sing ABBA songs in the shower. But then now I tell this to you in the class. And so that line moves a little bit away from the secret and a little bit toward the public, right? That act, that granting of consent to you to know that is an act. It's a verb. It's not a noun. And that's what privacy is. Privacy is the act. It's the verb. It's the doing of consent, or the granting of consent to know things about that identify me personally, that compose who I am. So that's the idea that of privacy as a verb. Privacy is something you do, not something you have. And what it is you do is you grant consent. And where you grant that consent is in between the secret and the public. You kind of move the line one way or the other. And what you grant consent about is personal identifying information. That is information that says something about you as opposed to everyone else in the world. I'm 6'3 as opposed to 6'8 or 5'8. Okay, so I think that's pretty good. I think that's a pretty good start for privacy, for the definition. I really want to underline strongly that there is this difference between privacy and secrecy. That's where a lot of people kind of get hung up intellectually. They have the idea that if something is a secret, then it's private. And we really want to say that, no, privacy has nothing to do with secrecy. Secrecy is kind of a noun. Privacy is more of a verb. Privacy is about decisions, determining what is and what is not secret. So to kind of wrap this up now, this is a good case, as I said at the start, that I tried to use to kind of consolidate everything I have just said about privacy. And so this is, in case you don't recognize, I suspect you do recognize, this is Kim Kardashian taking a selfie. And for anyone who doesn't know, Kim Kardashian is a social media personality everywhere all the time. And she is, I am saying here, the most private person in the world, which always comes as a shock to many people, since, first of all, almost everything she does is on visible every day. If you want to know what Kim Kardashian is doing right now, then if you tune into or surf over to TikTok or Instagram or one of these other of these sites, you will probably be able to find some image revealing to you what exactly she is doing now, or was doing in the last few minutes. Anyway, so she's someone about whom everything is known, and it's too much, right? I mean, it's not just what she's doing now. I mean, we've seen almost everything about her life, photographs, text, videos, too much information videos, all that kind of stuff. I mean, everything about her is out there, and there's almost nothing about her life that you could not discover. If I wanted to write a biography of Kim Kardashian, the amount of personal identifying information that is out there for me to get easily and free is limitless. Right? I know everything about her life. But it's still true, I want to say, that she is the most private person in the world. She has no secrets, but she's the most private person in the world. Why? I will ask that question. Why would that be? Why would she be how could she be the most private person in the world and also have no secrets? And hopefully, we will consider that sort of a case, so you can just take a moment more to think through that. But hopefully you come to the conclusion that the reason she's the most private person in the world is because she demonstrates such ruthless control over her personal information. It's true that she shares a lot of that information. She shares almost everything about her. I would say she shares everything about her life, but she's the one who shares it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that if I snuck into her house and started videoing things, her giant security guards would come and throw me through a window or something down the cliff, something terrible, right? So it's not like she just says anyone can get any information they want about her. That's not what it is. As I say, if I snuck into her house with my little selfie camera and started taking pictures, she would react very strongly against me. But she herself is taking pictures all the time, right? I mean, if I snuck into her house and took pictures, I would probably not get any pictures or any scenes that are any different than the ones that she herself puts up on the internet. But the difference is privacy. The difference is she is the one who controls what is seen and what is not seen. And as I say, if you want to find out, you can find out for yourself by going to Calabasas or something, going to wherever it is she lives and trying to sneak into her house with a camera. You will find out very quickly that she takes very seriously the distinction between her putting images of herself on Instagram and other people putting images of her on Instagram. That difference is exactly privacy. Kim Kardashian has control over access to her personal identifying information, and she exercises that control ruthlessly, and so therefore she is a kind of privacy queen, even though she has no secrets. The fact that she has no secrets has nothing to do with it. What matters, what's important for Kim Kardashian, is the fact that she's the one that decides what is and is not a secret. So that's the definition of privacy. So when we say that privacy is control over access to your personal identifying information, we have defined very clearly the two critical aspects. One is this idea of consent or control, the idea that privacy means you are making decisions about what is known. That's one. And then the other critical aspect is, we've said, then there's the personal identifying information. That's information that describes you. And what we've concluded here is there's probably more work to be done on that side to try and figure out exactly what counts as personal identifying information. Because the closer you look, the more difficult it comes to clearly decide exactly where the line is between things that say something about me and things that just say something. Like, what is the difference between James Brousseau has a height and James Brousseau is 6'3"? Okay, so those are the components of privacy. It's consent and personal identifying information. What I would like to do now is pretty much look at cases, and there's surveillance. There's an art exhibit, surveillance cameraman, Homeland Security, quick case. The second and third are quick. Then I want to talk a little bit about why we want privacy, what privacy is for, why it causes so much concern in the world. Then toward the end, we'll talk a little bit about techniques in information technology for protecting privacy. And then a final note that relates privacy to some of the things we have talked about already. Okay, so privacy, our first case, this case is from New York City. It is called The Neighbors. And The Neighbors is an art exhibit. This is an actual print from that exhibit. And it was from a gallery in New York City, the Julie Paul Gallery. You can see in the background here some other images from this exhibition, which were, these are photographs, I should say, these are all photographs, just straight photographs, taken by this man, Arne Svensson. And what is curious about this exhibition is that they were taken without the knowledge of the people who were the subjects. So you can see at the extreme here, there's a man with his back up against the window. I think that looks like maybe the same guy who's here sleeping on the sofa. Now, how did Arne Svensson get these pictures? The way he got these pictures is, it turned out that he was living in the building next to this building, the building that you see in the exhibit, and he just set up his camera in his own window and started taking pictures of what was going on in the apartments of the building right across the street. He set up a telephoto lens and snapped the pictures away. This sounds fairly creepy, but what he said is that this is art. And there are three components to this claim. The first is, he said, look, the window frames themselves, and he means things like, you can see the frame here, the T frame, and here in these pictures, you can also see that there are window frames. He says, look, the window frames themselves serve like frames of a painting. So there is some commentary being made here about the idea of art and its framing, and whether the frame, this is a discussion within the art world, to what extent the fact that there is a frame makes something as art, right? There's in almost every modern art museum, there's some exhibit that makes a comment on that question. Sometimes an artist will put a frame with nothing in it and then watches people come into a museum and there's a frame there, so everyone like looks in the frame. They think, well, because there's a frame, there must be art here. And then you could also ask questions like, well, one, is it the frame that makes the art exist? And then two, does the frame make the art better or worse, or so on? So there are all kinds of discussions. And then just quickly, I mean, another one I've seen is one where an artist will take a frame and put that in the gallery, but it's empty, and then take the canvas and put it right next to the frame, right? It's obvious that the canvas is the same size as the frame. It's made to be inside the frame. But you can look and see people get confused. Some people are looking at the canvas. Some people are looking at the frame, which is empty, nothing in it. That's what art people do, right? They make these conundrums and think about them. And he enters into that discussion. It makes sense. He says, look, there is a long and dignified discussion within the artistic world about how the idea of frames relate to the depiction of, you know, the painting or the photograph or whatever is inside the frame. And I'm entering into that discussion. He's saying, look, I have found in the world some kind of natural frames that are the windows of these buildings. And so he asks, does that make what is inside the frames art? Makes a lot of sense. And there's no doubt that counts within our culture as a serious artistic question. And then he also says, look, to protect, in some sense, the privacy of the people, I never show their faces. And you can see here that it's either the back of the person or it's part of the person. If we had more time, we could go through other images from the exhibition. But it's almost always something like this. It's the back of the person or just a part of the person. In one way or another, the face is not there. Now, right away, you have this question about personal identifying information. Part of the reason that he says that, or that we imagine that it's important that faces are not shown, is so that the people are not identified. We don't know who these people are. But on the other hand, I mean, like this guy, I bet if you, I know what building it was taken in because I've looked at the case. It's called the Zinc Building in Lower Manhattan on Houston Street. No, Canal Street. It's on Canal Street near the Hudson River. I bet, just from what I've seen here, that if I went to that building and stood around the door long enough, I would recognize when that guy came outside. I even recognize him here in this, at the extreme of this other picture in the red shirt. So I suspect that the fact that the faces are hidden does not fully protect the personal identity of the individuals. And so I think in that case, it's pretty clear that there is some kind of violation of privacy, right? We know something about, once we figured out who this guy is, we know something about him. We know that he naps during the day, which is a good thing. That's positive. And, you know, we know a little bit about the kinds of clothes he wears. Apparently, he doesn't wear a belt. He likes blue shirts. He likes plain colored shirts. Here, it's a kind of a red shirt. Looks like a guy, looks like he's about 35 or 40, something like that. Hard to tell, but something like that. So we know something about the age, something about sleeping habits, something about the clothing habits. All that is information that, to a certain extent, identifies him personally, right? The fact that he takes naps during the day is not like James Brousseau has a height. It's not like James Brousseau sleeps. It's more like James Brousseau is 6'3", right? Taking a nap is specific information about when you sleep and how you sleep. It's not just the fact that you sleep. So I think that this is, now you can say it's not very important, and maybe that's true, but it still nonetheless is the case, it seems to me, that this is personal identifying information that is being revealed in this art. So this is the case. That's the artist there, Arne Svensson, good Swedish name. And that's the gallery, the Julie Saul Gallery, which is, I think, in Greenwich Village or something. And the question is, well, I mean, why was it so easy to take these pictures? Well, this is a image from one of the apartments in this building, right? You can see the building is entirely made out of, the walls are entirely made out of glass. That was a selling point of the building. You get great light, right? The light shines in. If we had more slides, we could look at the real estate announcement for this building. As I say, it's called the Zinc Building. And it right away starts out by saying, do you want a big loft with lots of light? If you do, this is what you get. Right? And it's true. These are big open loft spaces. It's one of these nice old 1900 kind of built, 1888 or something buildings. Big, big space. They've tore off the walls and put on glass, and you do get lots of light and high ceilings. No doubt about it. It's truth in advertising. The problem is that if the light and the sun gets in, that also means cameras can get in. And that's what Arne Svensson took advantage of. So with this perspective in mind, I think that the discussion changes a little bit. If I just show you these pictures, I mean, it does look very creepy that the guy is telephoto into your personal living quarters. But then when I show you this picture and I say, look, the people intentionally moved into a place where their living walls are windows, where they are surrounded by transparent glass, right, as opposed to bricks, they chose that. They made that decision. So it seems to me that the circumstances change a little bit, and it becomes less clear that this is a privacy violation. I mean, if you yourself make the active decision to live in this apartment, are you giving consent to people to look at you, to take pictures of you? I mean, you can see through the windows of the of this apartment, you can see the windows of the other buildings. And kind of curiously, if you just look at the building that's kind of on the left side of this image, there you can see the windows of that building, and it looks like the shades are all pulled down. This is something, one of the ironies you sort of see in New York. You wander around the streets and you see these beautiful newer buildings with the huge glass everywhere, but everyone has their screens down because they realize too late that letting the sun in also lets everyone else's eyes in too, for better and worse, right? So in any case, bringing this back around, we have said that privacy is about consent. It's about deciding whether or not people can learn information about you. Just simple things. I mean, frequently when people talk about or think privacy, they think, you know, sort of intimate romantic things and things like that. But privacy also is just this is a private moment. Just when you take a nap and how you sleep. Sleep on your side, sleep on your front, that stuff. It's not a big deal, information, but that is private information. It's information that identifies you. So this is a real privacy case, and the information that is being distributed through these windows is personal identifying information. And the question is, are you giving consent to people to look at you and get this information about you when you move into this apartment? And by the way, it's not a move-in that you're going to do just without thinking too much, because this is downtown Manhattan. These are like multi-million, $5 million apartments. These are some of the most expensive apartments in New York City or in the world. You don't just kind of move in on a lark. I mean, if you move into this apartment, you have spent millions of dollars, and almost certainly you have taken a lot of time to think about that spending. So it seems like you could make the case that, look, someone who moves into this building made a decision to share a certain amount of information about themselves, right? The information that can be seen by anyone who happens to be living in any of these other buildings. Now, against that, someone might say, well, look, sure, you agreed to share kind of what can be seen in these distant figures on the sofa, but no one agreed to share what can be seen through a telephoto lens. So that's a distinction, right? Or is that not a distinction? Is it the case that when you agree, when you give consent to live in a building with these kinds of windows, then people can use whatever they want to see inside? I mean, you don't have any particular right, whereas you do have a right to dress and act and do what you would like inside your own apartment, of course. Just because you decide in your apartment to have big windows everywhere doesn't mean, it seems to me, that you have the right to decide that other people in their apartment cannot have telephoto lenses. Now, the fact that they use those telephoto lenses to look inside your apartment, maybe that's different. But I don't think you can just necessarily say that the fact that I buy an apartment with glass windows means that certain things that you cannot do in your apartment. I mean, usually we say that within the confines of their personal living space, people can do pretty much whatever they want. Certainly they can do whatever they want with cameras and napping and that kind of thing. Right? So it becomes very difficult in a case like this to figure out, it seems to me, whether or not this is a privacy violation. You're certainly giving some level of consent when you move into a building like this. And it seems like if you're going to say something like people can't use a telephoto lens to look through here, then it seems like even if there is a privacy violation in that sense, it seems like you're violating the autonomy of other people. I mean, it just seems like a stretch, at least to me, to say that because I decided to buy an apartment with a lot of glass windows, you cannot do something in your apartment. That seems like a stretch to me. But I'm not sure. In any case, what I want to set up is this question, which it seems to me is a very difficult question. In theory, it's really easy to understand. Privacy is the idea that I decide for myself who gets to know what about me. But in practice, am I decide that the form of that decision can be very difficult to fully understand. I mean, is moving into this apartment my granting consent to everyone else to take pictures of what goes on inside it? Maybe, maybe not. Seems to me it's unclear. And then here, the point I'm adding is about the domain and culture. I think another consideration that comes up is, in New York City, as you likely have noticed, everyone has a camera. Well, everyone has a camera now everywhere because of the mobile phone. But everyone always has their camera close at hand, and everyone is always taking pictures of everything. It seems like you can't walk three steps without looking around and seeing someone somewhere has their phone out and is taking a picture of something. Now, if that's the way it is in New York City, if everyone is always taking pictures of everything, does that change the way you think about consent in this building, right? I mean, it might be one thing if you lived in a building with lots of windows and you lived out in the distant, not even the sub, but in the country on a farm, right? You have a farmhouse in the middle of fields, and in that farmhouse, you decide to make a room with lots of windows. Now, in that case, right, you might be able to say, look, my building, this windowed room out in the middle of nothing, out in the middle of nowhere, far, far away from everyone, that does not give any consent to people to train a telescopic lens through those windows. However, in New York City, where everyone is taking a picture of everything, it seems like it's different. In New York City, if you're putting up clear windows like that, and every time you look around, people are taking pictures of everything, that seems to me as the rules are different in that case. And so my question is, are they different, or am I wrong about that? And if they are different, then what makes them different? How do we define when glass windows are a consent to take pictures of what happens inside, like is going on in New York City, and when conversely, the same glass windows are not consent, as might be the case if you build the same apartment, but out in the middle of farmlands, far, far away from any city. Or maybe not, right? I mean, someone could make the case, you could be a purist, and you can make the case and say, look, culture has nothing to do with it. Consent means consent. And the only people that can take pictures of you are people who have your explicit consent to take those pictures, regardless of what kinds of walls you put around yourself, glass or no glass, regardless of whether you're in New York City in Times Square or walking in the countryside. Of course, you can also take that position, and many people do, right? The pure, strong position is consent means consent, and that's it. I'm simply pointing out that when you look closely at the situation like this one, what counts as consent, it gets a little bit blurry, right? Because it seems like Arne Svensson, the artist, it seems like he can make the case that, look, if you're going to surround yourself with glass, you're giving me consent to look in and see what's going on. Maybe. And then another way of problematizing this would be the question about what the privacy is about. I mean by that is, are the rules for consent different for, let's say, art than they would be for healthcare or entertainment or something? That is, is it one thing if, look, Arne Svensson takes these pictures and says, well, I'm doing this in the name of art. Okay, great, fine. That's one way of violating someone's privacy, or maybe getting to the edge of violating their privacy. But what if instead of doing art, what if he worked for a AI healthcare company. And what they were interested in doing is doing studies about what people ate and when they slept and so on. But they did not want their subjects, they thought, and this would be reasonable too, right? If you tell someone they're subject to an experiment, then frequently they will change their behavior. So it makes sense. I mean, ideally, you want to do experiments on people without having them know they're being experimented upon. Now, that is obviously problematic for other reasons, but just thinking from the perspective of someone doing a healthcare study, let's say they want to study sleeping patterns and your diet, right? This is a very reasonable, this is the kind of thing people do want to know about. And someone who worked for a healthcare company set up the same camera that Arne Svensson set up and took the same images, but instead of using those images, right, to say, well, this is art about someone napping, instead of that, they used the same images to compile information and also information about when they were eating and such, to compile information about how people are living. So you say, look, we can see from the images that this person has breakfast at 8:45 a.m. and lunch at 1 and dinner at 8. And this person typically eats for dinner a steak and potatoes and typically eats for lunch a sandwich and so on. And then this person typically takes a nap at 3 o'clock on Saturdays. And when this person does not eat lunch, they have the nap at 1 o'clock. There's all kinds of data that someone who was in healthcare, who is legitimately interested in the connection between diet and sleep and other kinds of things, there's all kinds of information that they could glean from this study. Now, the question that I have here is, well, is that situation different from the art situation? Is it okay or not okay? Is it okay to take these pictures of someone and gain this information about how they live in the name of art, but not in the name of healthcare? Or is it the reverse? Is it okay in healthcare, but not art? Or is it both? Or is it neither? Does it make any difference, in other words, whether it's healthcare or art? And then you could say the same thing also about entertainment. And I add that one to the list because there's a very good, a very interesting case that I just saw recently. A company is giving away large screen TVs for free. You can have the TV for free, but there's a catch. The TV comes with a camera, which will be turned on and facing you. So you are giving away, at least in your TV viewing area, you're essentially putting up this big window and letting people just look in all the time. And they say that they are doing that for two reasons. Well, the main reason is they can read what's going on in the room. And they say, we're going to give you more targeted advertising because we will learn about your habits, like when you eat and so on. Plus, we will be watching your face and we will see when you're happy and sad about what you're viewing, so we can give you better recommendations for the movies and television shows that you see on this screen. I mean, all those things are true. They probably can give you better recommendations for products and for entertainment and so on. So they're doing the privacy, in this case, is different because they're doing the privacy violation, quote unquote, not in the name of art, not in the name of general healthcare, but they're doing it to help you, to, at least they say, right, to give you better entertainment options and so on. Of course, they're also doing it to make money for themselves. And then there's a second, in that case, there's a second complication too, and that is when you get the TV, you are made aware of the fact that there is a camera on the TV facing you in grabbing that information. So you would ask, is there any difference between having these open windows, which you just get because you want the sun to come in, and getting this television, which essentially provides a window onto you electronically? But you got that knowing, you got that because you got a free TV, and you got that knowing that advertisers would be looking at you. It seems like in that case, the case of the free TV, you could make a pretty strong argument that privacy is maintained because you are giving consent to them to take these images. You're simply saying, look, I will trade you this personal information about my life. You can look into my living room whenever you want, but in exchange for that, I get a free TV. Okay, I'm okay with that, right? That's kind of similar to the exchange that Kim Kardashian makes, right? She says, look, I can get a lot of money from a TV entertainment and shows and such, and all I need to do is let people constantly look into my living room and such. So there are just endless complications about what counts as consent. But I think that the one that's most illuminating to me that I have found is this one with the windows, because it seems like it's so close to a borderline case. You know, on the one side, it's true that you expect the walls of your home to provide a zone that is yours and yours alone, and other people cannot look in there. That makes perfect sense. But on the other hand, I mean, you just cannot, you cannot live in a place like this without realizing, my God, if I can look out, other people can look in. I mean, it just seems like that's got to be very, very close to giving consent to someone like Arne Svensson to start taking pictures. Okay, so there's no clear solution to the question about what counts as consent, but there is clarity and certainty that it's very complicated. Now, there are some other quick special cases we could talk about. Security cameras are one. There's a guy, these are fun videos. There's a guy called Surveillance Cameraman. I think his work it was on YouTube for a while. It got taken down, maybe put back up. Not sure. Kind of goes down and gets back up and then gets stripped down again. But what this guy does, Surveillance Cameraman, is the guy with the appropriately blurred out face and the camera. What he likes to do is he just takes a camera, a video camera, and he goes and sits down near people. Like this man here just sits, this guy with the phone was sitting by himself at Starbucks or something. Surveillance cameraman just sits right in front of him and starts filming him right from 2 feet away. And that's why the person has this expression. He's like, well, what are you doing? You go away, stop, leave. And right, you can see actually it is Starbucks because it's the Starbucks little sign up there, barely visible on the top. So he's just sitting at Starbucks and he sits down and starts talking on his phone, and surveillance cameraman comes, sits at the same table, and starts filming him. And the guy becomes very upset. But then what surveillance cameraman always does is he always arranges this to happen in a place, or he tries to arrange it to happen in a place where there are surveillance cameras also, that is, cameras that the store has. And so the person gets very upset. He says, stop filming me, go away. And then surveillance cameraman says, well, look, right there, there's another camera filming you the same way. Why aren't you upset about that camera? And most people are not upset, right? Most people say, well, that's a security camera. That's different. Well, is it? Why would it be? The question that surveillance cameraman asks is it different? And by the way, I mean, the videos are very funny because he just sits there. It doesn't say anything. It just keeps filming for a while. Then he points at the camera, but for a long time, he just films and the people kind of freak out. So it's, people watch the videos because they're funny. But in any case, that they are funny. But the important idea is that he does significantly draw this contrast with security cameras. And he makes the point, look, and we are being filmed all the time without our consent. And we don't seem to get upset about it. So is the fact that we are not, that we don't have protests. We have protest marches all the time for all kinds of stuff. But I've never seen, maybe I missed it, but I've never seen a protest march against surveillance cameras. Like, I've never seen 10,000 people walking down Broadway saying, down, down, surveillance camera. We just don't seem to care about them. And if that's true, I mean, if we don't care about them, then in some sense, aren't we as a society giving consent to these companies to put up these surveillance cameras and film everything? And if we are, we bring this back around to surveillance cameraman, then why are we objecting to the fact that he sits down and just starts filming us right there at the table? And besides the fact it just it's annoying to have him there. But the point he's making is, it really it's the same thing as the surveillance camera. So that's another complication of the idea of consent. I mean, is it possible for us to give implicit consent? Is the fact that we do not protest surveillance cameras, is that us collectively saying that people who use surveillance cameras have a right to take pictures of us and gather the information and use it however they want? So that's one special case, surveillance cameras. Another special case is this is from a hearing. Obviously, this is Representative Mike Rogers. So this is the United States Congress, and he's on the Intelligence Committee. He's, in fact, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. And this is the intelligence. It used to be that we tried to, in the United States, we tried to get intelligence about other countries like Russia. And now we try and get intelligence about ourselves. Where everyone is spying on each other now in the country, and probably inevitable sooner or later. And so he is talking about this video. You can see if you go onto C-SPAN and hunt for Mike Rogers and privacy, you will get this video where he's talking about United States government surveillance of the citizens. And he says the following. He says, look, the U.S. government successfully is surveilling the citizens, surveilling me and surveilling you and gathering that information. And no one's privacy is violated because the government successfully keeps the secret. Right. And then they turn off the cameras and they say what the secret is. But the government is very good at spying on us without us finding out. And his point is, what he says is, he says, look, since you don't know that the government is spying on you, is listening to your telephone calls and so on, since you don't know that, it doesn't change your behavior. I mean, it has no effect in your life, right? I mean, the fact that, unless it turns out that I'm saying on my phone, okay, I will put the bomb on flight 743 at 7 a.m. tomorrow, right? Unless I'm saying something like that into the phone, and God knows what's about to happen, right? And the agents come sweeping down and start searching your home for bombs and such. But unless I do something like that, which most of us don't do, I can't think of a time when I happen to be saying into my phone something about putting a bomb on flight 738. It just doesn't, it's not a normal conversation. And unless you do something like that, then the fact that my phone calls are being listened to by the National Security Agency, it doesn't change my life at all. So his point is, look, if your life is not changed by the fact that your personal information is gathered, then your privacy is not violated. So your privacy, so as I say here, the answer he has is your privacy can't be violated if you don't know about it, which is sort of like the philosophers have the old question, if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, there are a lot of ways to, that's actually a very good question, because there are many, many ways to think about that. But one just very simple way to think about it is, I mean, if something happens in the world and it has no effect, right, no one hears the sound, then it really doesn't matter. It's not worth thinking about or worrying over or even considering when we think about our experiences generally in the world. Things that have no effects are irrelevant. And so he's making that case. He's saying, look, it's okay for us to spy on our own citizens as long as they don't find out. Now you can, there are strong arguments against that too, right? The argument, to speak for him, the argument that he's making is for someone's privacy to be violated, they must actually know about it, because if they don't, it makes no difference in their lives. And if it makes no difference in your life, then it just doesn't exist. So we could, of course, this is a heavy philosophical question, and we could talk about this for 1,000. Well, we have, philosophers have been talking about this question in many different forms, for 2,500 years. So you can imagine how long the class could go on talking about the trees and sounds and things. But just remaining on this subject of privacy, the way that larger debate or discussion focuses on privacy is by saying, look, there are things that happen in the world where my personal information is being gathered, but I don't know about it. Very few other people know about it. It makes, therefore, no difference in my life. So can we say in that then that my privacy is not being violated? In some sense, I think that's a lot like the security camera question in the previous slide, right? The surveillance cameras, presumably, hopefully, what they're supposed to do is they're supposed to tape for 24 or 48 hours and then tape over that information. Though I bet that's happening less and less. I bet the information is being kept longer and longer. But ideally, the surveillance camera erases its own information. So the surveillance in that case typically has no effect. And so you can make the case, look, it doesn't matter. I'm not sure. It's an open question. Okay, so why don't we just take 5 minutes to think about that, to think about the question of the windows and the surveillance camera and the idea about whether or not, I think that's a good way to kind of focus the larger question, whether or not your privacy is violated if it doesn't make a difference in your life, and then how you decide whether or not a difference is made. I think that's a good way also of investigating privacy at one step beyond the question of what is consent and what is personal identifying information.